This is Paul Pachter, CEO of Long Island Cares, the Harry Chapin Food Bank, and welcome back to another episode of Breaking Bread from Long Island Cares. This is our show right here on YouTube where we talk about everything and anything, but it has something to do most of the time with hunger and food insecurity, but perhaps not today, because my guest is a friend of mine and a dear colleague who I have great respect for, and that's Dr. Jeffrey Reynolds, who is the CEO and president of Family Service Association of Long Island. They are clearly an historic organization. They were founded in the late 1800s. I don't know many nonprofits on the island that are over 100 years old. Jeff, thanks so much for doing the show and welcome.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Great to see you. So let's begin. I mean, 1886?
1884. Yeah.
An organization is founded here on Long Island when it was probably still potato farms.
Yes.
And it has lasted for like over 100 years. So let's talk about Family and Children's Association, what you do, and would you agree with my analysis that you've got an historic organization going?
Yeah, and I think that history put a special emphasis on COVID for us, because I was reminded by some of our board members, some of our staff, some of our donors, that this was not our first pandemic. And don't screw it up. And so from the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918 and 1919, through a couple world wars, through the recession, through Sandy, through 9/11, FCA has managed to persevere. And I'm really proud of the way we came through the pandemic. It's still not over for a lot of the folks we serve, as it isn't for yours. But it was really our staff that rose up. And in leading the organization, I guess I feel like my imperative is I've been given the privilege of running a really storied organization for a set period of time, and I'm going to do the best I can with it and then lovingly hand it off to somebody else for the next chapter. But that creates a real sense of responsibility.
Sure it does. And you offer a lot of services for many, many people, a diverse group of people. What's Family and Children's up to right now? Where are your big focuses if you had to pick three?
Yeah, so that's actually pretty easy for us to do, although I'll maybe make it four, because two are connected.
Okay.
Out of COVID, and none of these conditions came about as a result of COVID, but they're all worsened by COVID, the same way hunger existed pre-COVID, and now for some folks it's a deeper dynamic in their lives. Addiction treatment and recovery continues to be a big issue given the rate of overdoses here on Long Island that exceeds that they were even seeing in the five boroughs. We saw an increase in drug and alcohol use during COVID, and that's manifested itself in some lost gains when it came to the prevention work, the access to treatment work that we did pre-COVID, and the support for people in recovery. So I'm pretty proud of the fact that we've opened three recovery centers in the past 5 years, whereas before we didn't have any here on Long Island. Second area, and it's related, and this is a connection, is in kids' mental health. We run a kids' mental health program that serves about 400 kids per month. I've been in this field for a long time, and I've never seen it this bad in terms of attempted suicides, completed suicides, school refusal. You know, it's families are really struggling at this point in time. The uptick in gun violence has been very significant here on Long Island and elsewhere. And while elected officials can quibble over bail reform, you know, we've got a street-based intervention that is led by credible messengers, folks who have some experience in the communities we serve, like Hempstead, who are out there working to lessen the likelihood of retaliatory gun violence. And then the last issue, and I know it's a population you guys serve as well, is seniors.
Right.
And seniors were vulnerable, at risk, disadvantaged before COVID. I think COVID, again, we can argue about who's to fault for the nursing home debacle in New York State, but there's a lot of seniors who watched their spouses die in nursing homes via FaceTime, whose families haven't been able to afford it here and have moved on to other places that might seem more affordable, and who are dealing with depression, anxiety, a lack of access to care, and all the things that were there before, but I think now have been worsened. So those are just some of our focuses, I think. You know, historically, we have emphasized those issues, but also worked hard in communities that have been neglected for a long time. And I'm thinking of, you know, in Nassau, Hempstead, Freeport, Uniondale, Roosevelt, In Suffolk, it's a little bit more diverse, but it's CI, Bayshore, Brentwood, Amityville, Coram, Gordon Heights, Riverhead. All communities that require organizations like ours pulling together and trying to make a difference.
And all the investment that organizations like yours and ours now are making in diversity, equity, and inclusion, because we're looking at communities, as you say, which are populated mostly by people of color. We know that the fastest growing population group on Long Island are people from South America, Central America. It's estimated that by 2025, they will represent about 52% of the population. But let's unpack this one by one, if we can. Focusing in on substance abuse, the abuse of prescription drugs, party drugs for young people, the fentanyl epidemic that's affecting probably every single state. You know, it's always been my impression that Long Island or Long Islanders can't wrap their hands around problems that they feel shouldn't exist in suburbia.
Yeah.
Oh, fentanyl crisis? No, that in the Bronx maybe. Prescription drugs? No, that's going on in the city. The people who live in Manhattan? No, these problems are going on in Long Island and not just in communities of color. You know, the medicine chest has become one of the more popular dealers for young people to at least begin the spiral into drug abuse. It starts with prescription drugs in many cases. What are you seeing and what concerns you now after doing this for so many years? And here we are in 2022. If you were sitting down with both county executives, what would you tell them, guys, you need to open up your eyes because we have a major problem here?
Yeah, I think the challenge in suburbia is we do cast most of our problems off as being things that somehow can't make it through the Midtown Tunnel, and there's a notion that our white picket fences are going to protect us.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of heroin, that gave heroin a 10-year running head start on our kids. And then we tried to catch up with a half-hearted effort. And then almost as soon as we acknowledged it was a problem, we forgot about it. And here we are, we've gone from prescription drugs to heroin to fentanyl. And tomorrow it will be something else. And I think that would be my main message to the county executives, and that we have to stop chasing the drug du jour. And we have to get to the core of this. The core of this are adolescents who suffer from anxiety and depression and don't have good access to mental health care. Schools that don't have the proper training or interventions to pick up these things early on in the game. Treatment on demand is reality for some people, but not for everybody, particularly if you're female, particularly if you are pregnant or parenting female, or a young woman with an eating disorder. You know, treatment remains elusive for a lot of folks because of the insurance practices that have gone unchecked. And then we have to do a much better job of supporting people in recovery. I've been to a million and one quote-unquote graduations from drug treatment facilities, and there's really no other medical condition that's chronic in nature for which you graduate and get a pat on the back and go home. And, you know, with most medical conditions, we understand that there's a step-down process, and we know that for young people that use drugs for 5, 6, 7 years during those formative times, that we've got to rebuild that social and emotional learning. So taking drugs out of their life is real important, but the big question is, what are we going to help them put it back in? And our first response to substance use disorders is always criminal justice. And a criminal justice response to a public health problem leaves us nowhere. It hasn't worked since Nixon declared war on drugs in 1971. So I would say to both county executives, and I have, honestly, we've got to get to some of these core issues. We've got to make sure that we're working in concert with law enforcement, but not relying on law enforcement to deal with what amounts to a brain disease.
It's interesting because what you're saying, and I'm hearing, can hold true in mental health as well. You can't criminalize the treatment, you know, and I understand there are drug courts, and I understand that there are individuals who could be remanded to attend a program at Family and Children's Association, but you really have to look at the problem, number one, the root causes of it. What have we ignored for the past decade or more with a family member? I would imagine it might have gotten a little better by 2022, but are there families still in denial about their own children having drug abuse problems?
There are, and I think there's no good training programs to teach parents how to recognize the signs and symptoms of a mental health disorder or a substance use disorder, and there's always the notion that it's just a phase. Right. Most of the people our age kind of did our thing back in the day. Mm-hmm. The world didn't stop spinning on its axis. We're productive adults. Everything was okay. Yeah. And for most kids, that's the case. Mm-hmm. For the 10 to 20%, though, that suffer from more serious conditions or mm-hmm. wind up with a substance use disorder, it's not going to be okay without some intervention.
Right.
So I think parents are always reluctant to acknowledge there's a problem. Mm-hmm. They don't open up to schools. It's hard to get psychiatric care when you need it. Mm-hmm. And the biggest beef I have with parents, and I talk about this in school districts that have high net worth families, is mm-hmm. sometimes the behavior you model isn't the best. Right. If you need to pop a Xanax and have a glass of wine before mm-hmm. you get on a plane, you've now sent a message to your kid that the way you deal with anxiety and stress is yeah. to use a drink and a drug. Mm-hmm. If you come home from work and say, what a week, and immediately pop open vodka that's mm-hmm. stored next to popsicles in the yep. freezer, you sent a message. And I've said to parents, you know, what you say is important, but what you do is actually more important. Mm-hmm.
And what do you think? I mean, also, I'm thinking about younger people today having access to so much media. And it's not just social media, the Facebook and the TikTok, and I know that they all do their things on those platforms. For the last few weeks, I've been binging on high school dramas from other countries on Netflix. The mm-hmm. one I'm watching right now is called Control Z. And I thought of you when I was watching it, because everything is being laid to bear in these programs. The, you know, the club drugs, when you go out, you know, clubbing on the weekend, the access to the alcohol, the fact that a lot of kids are living in homes with rich families, like in Mexico and Spain, yep. and the families are traveling for business and the kids are left to their own devices. And the peer pressure that kids are going yep. through, you know, 18-year-olds, 17-year-olds, can be overwhelming. Yep. And if a parent is absent, you know, when this is going on, there's not much they're really going to be able to do until they get a knock on the door from someone in law enforcement saying, we busted your son or we busted your daughter. Oh, it's nothing. What do? They went to the medicine chest. They took one of my pills. No, they're actually selling these pills yep. at their school. What, you know, where do we as a society, when it comes to substance abuse, especially drug abuse, and you've mentioned all the stuff, the war on drugs, the Just Say No, none of it's worked. I read these days there's more money available right now for drug and alcohol treatment, mm-hmm. And I hope that your organization is getting some of it. Yeah. You also mentioned earlier about the community, you know, recovery programs like Thrive that you've opened up. So it's a two-point question. What do you say as a society we need to do, as a region we have to do? And then let's talk about the importance of the recovery programs.
So look, and when it comes to prevention, I think there's no guidebook for being a good parent. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, even everyday regular parenting is challenging in and of itself for the most well-adjusted and educated parent. It gets even more challenging when you have a kid that has some issues. Mm-hmm. I think now the threats are greater than they've ever been. I just think about the potency level of marijuana that's available these mm-hmm. days. When I was growing up, certainly fentanyl was not a thing. No. Heroin was a thing that was limited to certain communities. Yeah. Yeah. You know, you had kids that obviously smoked too much weed and didn't show up for class, but mm-hmm. that was basically it. Now we're at a point in time where a kid takes a pill at a party that could be laced with fentanyl, and they can be blue and shaking 3 minutes mm-hmm. later. And so I think the game has changed, but I don't necessarily know that parents understand how much the game has changed. And usually mm-hmm. when they find out, there too is a lead time while they're stuck in denial or off doing their thing instead of going to the school programs. I also think as educators, we made a lot of mistakes in that we've really, in some cases, not been very thorough in our prevention education messages. Mm-hmm. We said, just say no, you're going to ruin your brain, you're going to wind up incarcerated, you'll be homeless living in a box, and your world will come to an end. And if you drink a beer under the age of 15, you're going to be shooting heroin tomorrow. Mm-hmm. That's not the way it works for most kids. Mm-hmm. And if we took the time to have a more thoughtful conversation about the impact of drugs and alcohol, specifically mm-hmm. on the developing brain, and took more than a 40-minute class session to explain all of this, mm-hmm. I think we'd have an easier time with kids. They wouldn't think we're lying to them. They wouldn't think we're exaggerating. When we go into districts now, it's very often you have 45 minutes, scare the heck out of them, and hope yeah. for the best. Or we send cops into classrooms right. and say, if you deal drugs, I'm going to catch you and I'm going to lock you up. drug abuse doesn't work in that way. It's doesn't a very work. Complex behavior.
Doesn't work with the scared straight model. Right. That's right. You know, that may be good for incarceration and the criminal justice system, but not when we're dealing with community treatment for drugs.
It doesn't.
We have absolutely ran out of time for this episode. Stay here because we want you to come back and do another episode with
Let's
us.
Let's do it.
And we'll talk about mental health. There's so much that you've unraveled for me. Jeff Reynolds is the president and CEO of Family and Children's Association right here on Long Island, one of the experts in the field of substance abuse, drug abuse, and mental illness. And we're going to bring him back and we're going to talk a little bit more about the issue. You've been watching Breaking Bread from Long Island Cares. I'm Paul Pachter, the CEO of Long Island Cares. I want to thank CardWorks for all the support they provide us. If you have any financial or accounting needs, visit CardWorks online at cardworks.com, where they treat you really like a great customer. So until we see you next time, continue to take care of each other. Stay well. See you next time. Paul Pachter, CEO of Long Island Cares and the Harry Chapin Food Bank, and welcome back to another episode of Breaking Bread at Long Island Cares. This is our YouTube program where we bring you into the workings of the regional food bank and talk about hunger and food insecurity, but we also bring in guests from the outside. And some of my dear friends and colleagues in the nonprofit field have been on this show many, many times. And we're welcoming back Dr. Jeffrey Reynolds, who is the president and CEO of Family and Children's Association here on Long Island, one of the premier drug mental health organizations dealing with a range of, you know, topics related to the issue of substance abuse and mental health. Jeff, welcome back. It's good to see you again.
Thanks. Always a pleasure. We ran out of time last time.
We ran out of time.
Because we were just getting into stuff.
We were getting into it.
Happy to finish the conversation.
You know, but online, people unfortunately don't spend hours watching online programs.
That's probably better.
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, last time you were on, we were really getting into the issue of substance abuse.
Yeah.
But then there's this whole other component of Family and Children's Association, which deals with mental illness and mental health, which is something that I know a little bit about, having spent 27 years of my career in the mental health system. And I'm going to start off with a similar question that I asked you when we were together last time. From your perspective, what's the state of mental health on Long Island right now?
I'll give you a perfect example of where we are. On the way over here, I got a call from a parent who was looking for a psychiatrist for her 15-year-old. She called a psychiatrist's office, well-known psychiatrist in Suffolk County, and was given an appointment in the second week in January. Wow. Lots of bad things can happen to kids over the course of 4 or 5 months, and lots of bad things are happening to our kids who struggled very severely during COVID. Again, mental health issues existed pre-COVID, but they were worsened during COVID, and you had kids that were locked in their homes, away from guidance counselors, away from school social workers, away from their peers. They're now returning to school, and lots of folks are happy to be back and all gung-ho. There's a lot of kids, though, that are suffering anxiety like they never experienced before, who are refusing to go to school, who have experienced learning loss, and you had students that were A students that all of a sudden are struggling and blaming themselves. And, you know, look, adolescence is a really unsure and tenuous time. And I think kids and parents alike are really struggling through all this. There's a ton of money being pushed at school districts, probably not enough, but no, it's a step in the right direction, but it doesn't solve the community piece of it. And if you think about this historically, you probably had some direct experience with this. Years ago, New York State closed down a lot of the psychiatric facilities for kids, for adults as well. And the promise was, and it wasn't implied, it was stated, the explicit promise was, we're going to bolster community-based services and be able to maintain people in their own home environments and without expensive dehumanizing hospitals. They did the first part really well. Kings Park is shuttered.
Right.
It's full of graffiti.
Central Islip is closed.
But they didn't follow through on the second piece. And so that investment in community-based services has really been insufficient at best. And as a result, we see a mental health crisis in kids so badly that a bunch of national organizations recently went to President Biden and asked him to declare a national emergency when it comes to kids' mental health. Again, not new, mm-hmm. because it existed in before COVID ever hit, but it's been exacerbated, and now it's on full display. And, you know, I'm optimistic that there'll be some more dollars and some more mm-hmm. innovative programs and all of this. You know, one of the things I would love to see, and we've done this in other spaces, is the use of kids themselves mm-hmm. to be peer mentors to their colleagues. Because I think sending social workers into schools is phenomenal. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
But we found that in a lot of cases that peer-to-peer outreach makes all the difference in the world. And the reality is all of our kids know which peers are struggling. Mm-hmm. They know sure. more about their friends than parents do, than teachers do, than mm-hmm. sports coaches do. And I think, you know, some of the more innovative programs involve almost deputizing those young people to be a care team, mm-hmm. an informal care team in schools.
And the mental health system has had some successes with adult peer-to-peer
yeah.
counseling and
yeah.
relationships. You know, you talk about government, and, you know, I go back all the way to 1963 with the Comprehensive Community Mental Health Act, where it was under President Kennedy, and the issue was take the dollars out of the institutions sure. and put them into the community. Some communities did it, some communities mm-hmm. didn't. There's always been a lot of stigma and opposition lodged at mental illness and the mental health system. I remember I was personally involved trying to open up, you know, structured community residence programs and getting backlash from the community. It's a hard thing for people to come to terms with. Maybe now in 2022, since I think more than half of the people who got through COVID didn't get through without being scarred by something.
Yeah.
And, you know, you bring up the point that at the top of the list of people having trouble are children.
Yeah.
And that's a hard, excuse the pun, that's a hard pill to swallow for anyone to realize that we're leaving children out there on their own. You know, the schools are trying to come back, businesses are trying to come back, but the work that you do and your staff do at Family and Children's Association, it is the essential work. Other than depression, anxiety, I'm assuming some peer pressure and bullying, what are you seeing in kids today, and how severe? I mean, do you think we're at a point with children's mental health where you would advocate for opening up more inpatient beds?
I think we need them.
Really?
There are kids that are really sick and really a danger to themselves. And so, you know, here in Suffolk, we've actually seen some innovations. The Dash Center right up mm-hmm. the block is right. certainly one of those innovations. Yeah. We're working with CN Guidance to do a similar type of thing in Nassau County. Mm-hmm. But we need more of those community-based centers. If they're mm-hmm. not hospitals, and I'm not a fan of hospitalizing right. kids, make mm-hmm. no mistake about it, but parents don't have options. And where mm-hmm. there are options, there tend to be waiting lists. So I think, you know, part of this is, yes, reopening some of those slots, reopening mm-hmm. some of those beds, but also, you know, walk-in clinics would be critical. Those crisis stabilization centers would be critical. We rely too heavily on emergency rooms.
Right.
And every parent that's
yeah.
done it before knows you go to the emergency room, you sit for 5 hours, your kid is discharged. Now they're angry and upset in the back
yeah.
of the car as you drive home and they miss yet another day of school.
Yep.
And so I would love to see some new models of care. Our home-based programs have been reasonably successful mm-hmm. where we offer parents respite services and those types of things. But Paul, there too, I will tell you, there was a point 2 or 3 years ago where we were hemorrhaging money and I went to the state and said, unless you give us a whole bunch of money, I have to close these programs down because mm-hmm. I can't afford to do it anymore. It's pulling down the entire organization. And so the adequate investment is critical. And then I think also educating parents about how to respond mm-hmm. to a mental health crisis in your kids. What are the signs and symptoms? How do you recognize it? What do you do? Who do you call?
Mm-hmm.
Most pediatricians don't know how to do this, and that's who families turn to first.
You probably have alliances with some of the major hospitals,
some of
the regions, you know, great pediatricians.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine that between your organization, the hospital, the pediatric association, that everybody is working together to try and put pressure on government to say, look, you need to fund these adequately. It's not enough just to talk about it. I know that Nassau County recently, and perhaps Suffolk, got an infusion of money to do mental health services.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see that money getting out to the agencies that need it the most?
You know, one of the things that's challenging is that there's these big announcements, there's press conferences, there's, you know, microphones and mm-hmm. big checks, and then then you hope that the money gets out the door into programs and to the people who need it fast enough. And the bureaucracy, as you know, can be really, really stifling. And you know, during COVID, government said, you know, we're partners with you. We're going to relax some of the regulations. We're actually going to roll up our sleeves and function effectively for the best possible outcomes. And now the pendulum has swung back the other way, and that all the bureaucracy that existed pre-COVID is back times 10. And so, you know, I've participated in more than one of these press conferences around opioid settlement dollars or new infusions of cash. And then you find out, well, the money isn't going to be out the door for 3 months. And I'm sitting there in the back of my mind, sometimes not even in the back of my mind, wondering, you know, how long will it take to get the money into programs, and how many people are we losing in the process? So when you look at the overdose crisis, and Long Island lost 700 Long Islanders last year, when you look at the suicide crisis among kids, and those are just the deaths. If you figure in the family dysfunction and chaos and everything that goes with it, both now and downstream, time is wasting. Yeah. And I worry a lot about how quickly we can make these changes before we're paying a bigger price downstream. And part of the problem is we don't respond fast enough.
Right. I mean, we don't have the resources to respond fast enough when the problem keeps escalating.
Right. And you're chasing. It's almost like you're always a step behind.
And that's, unfortunately, that's not the way we're going to correct the situation. Right. You know, I go back to when, after 9/11, New York invested a lot of money in a program called Project Liberty to deal with the aftermath of the attacks on the Trade Center. And we sort of knew that maybe it'll be 10 years, maybe it'll be 20 years, where people can finally, you know, say, I'm okay, and I'm never going to be 100% okay, but I'm okay. And now with COVID, I see the same thing. Yeah. But COVID, this was a life-altering experience for people. This wasn't, you know, a temporary, you know, crisis. This is going to go on for many years to come, decades. And, you know, the organizations hopefully are there, but government and the insurance companies and everyone else that has a role to play and a responsibility to fund these services, they have to be there as well. I know that, you know, there's so much pressure, especially on young kids today, the high school, the middle school group, even some of the college folks. All they have to do is turn on their phone, and they can either be loved or they can be hated, they can be threatened or they can be comforted. And, you know, we can't seem to break that reliance on the handheld computer, which is creating a lot of problems for people. And it's not to say use your phone responsibly. It's really for the schools to have a discussion with their student body that says, you know, how do you treat people?
Right.
You know, if someone is struggling with a mental illness, whether it's brought on by substance abuse or brought on by environmental pressure, the right thing is not to sit there and, you know, attack them and criticize them, because behind every child that suffers from an emotional problem is a family that's suffering from the same problem. So what do you tell families? Because I know they're looking for answers.
Well, look, there too, as adults, we model behaviors. Right? Mm-hmm. Remember when Charlie Sheen had his very public breakdowns? And it was like a circus show for most people. And there was no one who said, this is a person who's experiencing a mental health issue. We should have compassion. It's not for ridicule. You know, Kanye, you know, another example, someone who's publicly struggling, and we don't necessarily view it as publicly struggling. They become the butt of late night jokes and such. So I think part of it is creating that awareness. And I think we have a golden opportunity to do that. And the golden opportunity is this. Virtually everybody felt some mental health consequences associated with COVID. Even the most well-adjusted, and I put that in quotes because I don't really know what it means, person experienced the anxiety, the uncertainty, the depression of being home every day, the wondering what comes next. And I think that maybe perhaps provides a basis for us to begin to understand what some folks go through times 10 on a daily basis. So I think that's the piece, that's the opportunity here, right? There are some downsides to COVID. There are some downsides to us declaring it over prematurely. But I think the upside is, for the first time, people got a taste of that uncertainty, that natural anxiety that comes on an everyday basis. And I've said to more than one person, now imagine that's your life times 10 each and every day. And imagine you're 13 or 14. And so my hope is that out of this comes a new sense of empathy. But I always say to parents, the best piece of advice I can give you is to trust your gut. Same advice we gave people after 9/11. If you see something, say something. And if something doesn't look right, talk about it.
I think what you're saying is so important, in that when it comes to mental health, mental illness, regardless of who the individual is, a child, an adult, a senior, the issue is for us as a society to have some empathy for these people. You know, it's, you know, when someone is dealing with mental illness and struggling with it, they really need people to listen and have an empathetic ear, as opposed to just, you know, putting them down or blaming the parents or blaming themselves. We can go on and on and on, but like last time, we just keep running out of time here with you, Jeff. I'm looking forward to having you back sometime in the future.
I welcome you.
You know, we are so lucky here on Long Island to have you and to have your organization and your staff. You know, look, if you need help, whether it's with substance abuse, a drug problem, mental illness issues, please reach out to your to an organization that you can trust. How would people get in touch with Family Service Association?
Sure. We have a website. It's fcali.org or familyandchildrens.org.
Right.
We're happy to help. And, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't thank you for all you do and all this organization does for Long Islanders, too. We're lucky to have you as well, for sure.
Well, that makes us two very lucky professional people. Jeff,
absolutely.
A pleasure.
My pleasure.
Okay. If you want to follow us on YouTube, please do. We bring you Breaking Bread as soon as we tape new episodes. I want to thank our sponsors from Cardworks, Financial and Accounting Services, for their support of the program. If you have a comment, if you have some information that you need, please get in touch with us. Visit licares.org or call us at 631-582-FOOD. Until next time, this is Paul Pachter, CEO of Long Island Cares. Stay well and take care of each other.